Good morning, and thank you for joining us today at our Q2 results presentation. I'd like to start by giving you some key headlines for the quarter. Overall, the results are in line with our expectations. We're delivering on our strategy, and we have reiterated our guidance. The experience we are offering our customers is improving materially across all areas of the group. We're bringing together BT, Consumer, and EE and look forward to continuing to drive convergence on our products and services. We're making significant investments in the U.K. infrastructure, and we're ready to go further with fiber to the premise and our universal broadband commitment, subject, of course, to support from government and the regulator. This complements the investments we are making to roll out 4G across the country, of course. We're progressing with our group-wide performance and efficiency programs, including taking action to focus global services on a suite of digital products for our large multinational customers. We're engaged with our pension scheme members, the unions, and the trustee to find a solution that provides long-term stability for BTPS whilst giving BT the ability to invest and grow. Finally, as we look ahead, we'll have a number of important decisions to make relating to FTTP, UBC, pensions, spectrum, and content, and I am confident in the steps we are taking to address these challenges. Moving to Q2 results, this has been an encouraging quarter in which our consumer businesses have performed well, notably EE, although we've had some challenges in enterprise, in particular global services, where we are taking a robust set of actions to improve performance. Underlying revenue was down 1.5% for the group. Adjusted EBITDA was down 4%. This was impacted by investment in customer service and sports rights, together with higher pension operating charges, increased business rates, and trading in global services. This was partly offset by our cost-saving activities. Normalized free cash flow was 689 million, down 205 million from last year, primarily due to higher working capital and increased CapEx. On slides six and seven, I'll give you an update on progress versus our strategy for customer experience and investment, and then Simon will cover cost transformation in his presentation. Starting with customer experience on slide six. Customer experience is fundamental to everything we do, and our investments are having a positive impact across the group, as you can see from the metrics on this slide. Net Promoter Score on a group-wide basis has steadily improved for several quarters, and our right first time metric was up 2.3% versus the 2016-17 baseline. Onshore call handling is at 100% on EE and 85% on BT Consumer, and average call waiting time continues to fall. Ofcom complaints data showed improvements in Q2. In fact, EE recorded its lowest ever level of complaints. Our digital strategy is gathering pace. We launched a new business app. Usage on My BT app is up 50%, and My EE has also gone past 10 million downloads. Fixed copper network faults were 2% lower at the half year after another quarter in which we reversed what has been a long-term trend in rising faults. We'll continue to invest in the coming quarters to give our customers the experience they deserve. On slide seven, I'll talk about how we're investing for growth in a number of critical areas to maintain our leadership of fixed and mobile networks. EE continues to enhance its network by widening geographic coverage, upgrading cell sites from 2G to 4G, rolling out 4G Plus in more places, and preparing for 5G. We continue to get recognition for this, recently winning best-in-class reports for both P3 and Opensignal. We're playing our part to ensure that 95% of U.K. homes and businesses will have access to super-fast broadband by this December. The government is considering our offer to deliver a minimum of 10 megabits universal broadband commitment to the whole of the U.K., and Ofcom is now consulting on this proposal via the Wholesale Local Access Market Review, and we look forward to a positive outcome. With ultra-fast, we now have passed around 770,000 homes and businesses. and we intend to accelerate our GFAS deployment, which is now in 46 pilot locations, to cover 1 million premises by year end. In terms of broader rollout of FTTP, the first phase of the OpenReach consultation is now complete. The feedback from CPs has shown broad support for FTTP and a fibre switchover, which we see as critical to the success of the fibre build. We're often asked how we've been able to drive down the cost of FTTP to £300 to £600 per home passed. We're working on a number of initiatives to decrease costs and increase the speed of deployment to take us to the competitive cost point. These include a new trenching machine that can dig an average of 300 metres a day for as little as £3 per metre and lay the duct six times quicker than before. A new connectorized blocks and plug-and-play fibre frame make the task of joining fibre a much simpler and quicker operation. We will continue to innovate as we gain more practical deployment experience. Lastly on this slide, I want to bring you up to date on our planning for All IP. All IP will bring significant benefits to our customers, such as real-time provisioning and digital line quality. We're already seeing strong demand for such products in the B2B market, and we intend to move solely to All IP product solutions by 2025. Taking a look at regulation on slide 8, it's important to note we are constructively engaged with Ofcom and moving forward in our discussions. We're getting on with delivering the digital communications review as agreed with Ofcom in March. We've refreshed the OpenReach brand and there's progress on implementing the OpenReach governance framework. The new board under Mike McTighe is providing strong independent leadership and we expect OpenReach Limited to be incorporated shortly. As part of the WLA process, we are engaged with Ofcom on the issue of earning an acceptable return on our investment in both Superfast and Ultrafast. As you know, the CAT upheld our appeal against the business connectivity market review, and we await publication of the detailed reasoning. And finally, a word on spectrum. The decision by Three UK to launch a legal challenge has obliged us to make our own legal representations, and the case will come to court in December. This will not delay plans to expand 4G coverage and bring 5G to the market. Moving on now to the performance of our customer-facing units. As you know, we will bring BT Consumer and EE together into a single reporting unit from April next year. But until next April, BT Consumer and EE will report separately, and so I will start with the performance of BT Consumer on slide 10. Revenue was up 1%. The key value drivers, ARPU and RGU per subscriber, we're up 6% and 3% respectively. We are pleased that the Superfast broadband is continuing to grow apace, taking the fibre base to 57%, although it has come clear in recent quarters that the level of market growth for new net subscribers is slowing. Our growth slowed in TV, partly in response to our decision to introduce charging in BT Sport during the quarter. We saw an 8% increase in viewership on BT Sport and believe viewing will remain high due to the strong presence of UK teams in the Champions League. In line with our strategy, we're also looking at ways to drive ARPU through more-for-more offerings. Investment in customer experience has once again impacted our costs, along with sports rights, and as a result, EBITDA fell 3% in the quarter. Moving on to EE on slide 11. Revenue grew 4% as post-pay and fixed broadband growth outweighed the expected decline in prepay. This is the fourth consecutive quarter of revenue expansion, highlighting the success of our more-for-more pricing strategy. Our operating KPIs were healthy once again. Mobile ARPU was up 9% and churn remained very low at 1.2%. Total mobile base across BT remained flat at 29.7 million. As post-paid gains compensated for prepaid losses. We're delivering our part of the ESN contract on time, and our network continues to lead the UK market for both coverage and quality. And we were pleased to be ranked best network by P3 and Mobile Choice. Further, on customer experience, we opened four new showcase stores, and demonstrated unique innovation capabilities as the sole UK network for the new Apple Watch. We're clearly pleased with a 16% increase in EBITDA. I should note, however, that we expect customer investment costs to step up in the second half due to high-profile handset launches like the iPhone X, for which we're seeing strong early demand. Looking at business and public sector on slide 12, revenue was down 2%, with declines in traditional voice products and public sector offsetting continued growth in mobile and networking. The performance of SME and corporate was robust. As you can see from the chart, we've had strong mobile growth for a number of quarters, driven by SME and corporate, and we're now seeing increased demand in the public sector too. Order intake was down 14% this quarter, but was up 22% on a 12-month rolling basis. In H1, we signed contracts with Severn Trent, First Group, and the London Borough of Bromley and NHS Lanarkshire. As we've previously flagged, we continue to see the roll-off of the last two remaining public sector contracts. Adjusting for this, we're confident the performance of the public sector has stabilised. Let's move to global services on slide 13. It was a tough quarter for this business unit. Underlying revenue was down 11%. Excluding our Italian businesses, revenue was down 8%. In addition to challenging market conditions, the decline is also explained by our decision to de-emphasize low-margin businesses such as IP exchange and equipment sales. Whilst our contract win rate has remained broadly stable, the prior year included a number of large contract renewals, and we are seeing a reduction in the size of contracts along with more competitive bidding. Consequently, our total order intake for the quarter was down 38% and down 25% on a rolling 12-month basis. EBITDA was down 39% and down 28%, excluding the Italian business. This reflects the completion of certain contracts, trading conditions, and includes higher lever and pension costs. I'd like to highlight three aspects of our two-year restructuring program in global services. Firstly, in order to respond to changing market conditions, we're developing more digital solutions for our customers. For example, during the quarter, we launched Agile Connect, the first step in our dynamic network services strategy. This gives customers greater control of their infrastructure, as well as faster and more secure ways of setting up new sites. We also announced a strategic partnership with Amazon Web Services to enhance our cloud offering. Secondly, we're shifting our focus away from single country customers in favor of global customers where we are truly differentiated. And thirdly, we are pressing ahead with restructuring global services to make ourselves a more efficient competitor, particularly in Europe, by streamlining and simplifying the business and operating model. Turning now to wholesale and ventures on slide 14. Revenue fell 3%. There was weakness in legacy data and broadband, and managed solutions, which is partially offset by a better performance in mobile and ventures. Within ventures, we were pleased with the contributions of messaging, supply chain and fleet, which was offset by the continued decline in phone books. At the end of Q2, we had 26 in-link UK kiosks in operation, up from 3 at the end of quarter one, and we've been really encouraged by the advertising yields that they generate. Q2 order intake was up 16%, driven by some slippage of deals from Q1, and was up 32% on a rolling 12-month basis. On to Openreach on slide 15. Revenue was up 1%, driven by 21% growth in fibre broadband and 2% growth in Ethernet, which helped offset regulatory drag and an ongoing reduction in the copper line base. EBITDA was down 1%. Reflecting price changes along with business rate and pension operating charges weighing on our costs. Openreach added 505,000 new fibre connections, one of our strongest ever quarters. More than 27 million UK homes and businesses now have access to Superfast, of which 32% are now connected. We also extended our Ultrafast network, which now passes around 770,000 premises. We recorded a second quarter in which copper network faults fell, They are down 2% at the half year, reversing a long established trend. And we remain ahead on all 60 copper MSLs. We are pleased with the responses to our Openreach FTTP consultation. EPs have indicated broad support for scale builds and acceptance of the need to for FTTP switchover from copper. There are still challenges. For example, we need to agree a fair mechanism of cost recovery. Going forward, Openreach will consider the responses carefully and invite views from CPs on a more specific set of proposals later in the year. I'll now hand over to Simon to discuss the financials in more detail.
Well, thank you, Gavin, and good morning to everybody. Over the next few minutes, I will cover a number of topics. I will first summarise our financial results for the second quarter. I'll then update you on our productivity and cost transformation programmes and EE integration. And I'll then outline some changes that we intend to make to our reporting before concluding with a reconfirmation of our outlook for this year. So, starting with the Q2 results on slide 17. Revenue was down 2% in the quarter to £6 billion, and underlying revenue was down 1.5%, driven mainly by declines in our enterprise units, which were only partially offset by a strong performance in EE. Global services, in particular, remains challenging. And as Gavin has already mentioned, we have a comprehensive action plan to improve the performance trajectory of the global services business. Adjusted costs before depreciation and amortization of £4.1 billion declined 1%. Underlying operating costs, excluding adverse foreign exchange movements of £33 million and a £40 million decrease in transit costs, were down 0.3%. Our restructuring and cost transformation programs, combined with lower payments to other telcos due to lower IP exchange volumes, have offset increased costs of customer investment, higher business rates and pension charges, both of which rose by about £25 million, and an increase in sports rights of about £11 million. And as I mentioned at Q1, we expected to see the full impact from changes in EU roaming regulation in Q2. The actual impact in this quarter was low tens of millions of pounds. As a reminder, our guidance for the financial impact of EU roaming is high tens of millions of pounds this financial year. Adjusted EBITDA of £1.8 billion was down 4% year on year, with strong growth in EE offset by declines in our enterprise businesses, primarily global services, which included a £20 million EBITDA decline due to our Italian business. Moving below EBITDA on slide 18, D&A of £892 million was up 3% year on year, driven primarily by increased investment in Openreach. Our adjusted net finance expense of £130 million was down 11%, primarily due to reductions in the average net debt and the average interest rate paid on that net debt. We expect our effective tax rate for the year to be around 20%. The Q2 tax rate was broadly unchanged from Q1, giving rise to a tax charge of £161 million for the quarter. This resulted in the adjusted profit after tax of £628 million, that's 12% lower than last year. Specific items after tax of £104 million were primarily a result of restructuring costs of £52 million, EE integration costs of £14 million, and a net interest charge on pensions of £54 million. Reported profit for the period after specific items was £524 million pounds. Turning to cash flow on slide 19. We start with adjusted EBITDA of 1.8 billion pounds. Tax paid, excluding the cash tax benefit of pension deficit payments, was 113 million pounds. That's down 29% from last year as a result of early payments in our first instalment for 16-17. Working capital outflows of 141 million pounds primarily reflect phasing, which we fully expect to normalise through the year. This also included a large Openreach CP who chose not to pay when due, resulting in the late receipt of around £60 million, which will now be included in Q3 cash flow. Changes in provisions increased £76 million, that's mainly due to an increased pension operating charge, with net finance cash costs slightly improved on last year. So this resulted in cash available for investment and distribution of £1.56 billion. CapEx was up 16% to £870 million. The increase of £119 million was primarily the result of our increased investment in our fixed and our mobile networks. Other CapEx categories were broadly flat year on year. As a result, normalised free cash flow was £689 million in the quarter. That's down £205 million compared to last year, primarily due to that working capital phasing and the increase in network investment. The net cash cost of our specific items was £382 million. This included payments related to the settlement of warranty claims under the 2015 CE acquisition agreement of £225 million and regulatory payments of £83 million, mainly in relation to Dean's consent. After specific items and a cash tax benefit from pension deficit payments, free cash flow was an inflow of £321 million. Net debt at the end of Q2 was £9.5 billion. That's up around £700 million since the end of Q1 due to the payment of last year's final dividend of £1 billion, offset by free cash flow inflow. Turning to the dividend, the board has decided that from next year, the interim dividend will be fixed at 30% of the prior year's full-year dividend per share. However, in this transitional year, we decided to hold our interim dividend at 4.85 pence per share. The decision on the full-year dividend will be made at our preliminary results. Our progressive dividend policy remains unchanged to maintain or grow the dividend each year whilst reflecting a number of factors, including underlying medium-term earnings expectations and levels of business investment. So moving now on to the pension, the IAS 19 pension position at the end of Q2 was a deficit of £7.7 billion net of tax, which is broadly flat versus Q1. The triennial valuation is proceeding, and constructive discussions continue with the BTPS trustees. We still expect to complete the triennial valuation in the first half of the 2018 calendar year. We are considering a number of funding options to address the deficit, including arrangements that would give the BT pension scheme a prior claim over certain BT assets. We continue to review the future pension benefits under our main defined benefit and defined contribution schemes in the UK, with the objective of providing fair, flexible, and affordable pensions. Discussions with our unions are continuing, and we expect to undertake a 60-day consultation with our affected employees shortly. A court hearing will also take place in early December to determine the appropriate approach for the future indexation of benefits for Section C members of the BT pension scheme. Now, turning to slide 21, all our cost transformation initiatives are delivering on or ahead of plan. Starting with the EE integration, we announced run rate savings of £150 million at the end of the first year, and this has now increased to £250 million. We are firmly on track to achieve our stated objective of £400 million by the end of the fourth year. Savings have been generated from a number of areas, including renegotiating supplier terms, insourcing a range of activities across technology and business services, rationalising our combined property estate, and reducing head office and support employees. The restructuring programmes that we announced at our full-year results are also on track. We outlined in Q4 that we would remove around 4,000 roles over a two-year period. So far, we've achieved just under 40% of this total, and over the second half of the year, we expect to remove a further 1,500 roles. These programs are focused principally in global services, TSO, and our group functions. Gavin has already described the actions we're taking in global services. Within group functions, one of the major changes has been to create a new business services unit that brings together previously disparate shared service activity. The new unit will drive sustainable improvements in service and productivity in our back office activities by leveraging scale economies, simplifying processes and systems, and increasing the use of robotics and automation. We expect to generate savings of more than £150 million this year from these restructuring programs and annualised savings of £300 million when complete. The programs will deliver a two-year payback on implementation costs of £300 million. Most of these implementation costs will be incurred this year, and so far we have incurred £104 million. In addition to the EE integration and restructuring programs, we are obviously continuing to drive productivity improvement and cost reduction through our continuous improvement programs running in every business. This includes the delivery of both organizational efficiencies and procurement savings. Now, turning to slide 22, I'd like to outline a new package of disclosures that we intend to introduce to further improve transparency, to better align disclosures with the underlying business drivers, and to simplify reporting and build a longer-term focus for our business. Now, firstly, as I mentioned at our Q4 results last year, we're currently preparing for the transition to IFRS 15. That's the new revenue recognition standard that we'll be adopting from Q1 of next fiscal year. We expect to adopt the standard on a modified retrospective basis. So this means that we'll not restate prior year comparatives, but will instead restate our 1st of April 2018 opening reserves for the full cumulative impact of adopting this standard. We do, however, intend to provide analysis of the expected impact of IFRS 15, including pro forma restated results for prior quarters by customer-facing units during Q1 2018-19. At the same time, we intend to refresh our operational KPIs, including combined metrics for the new consumer unit. We'll continue to report under the current arrangements for the rest of this financial year. However, between Q4 2017-18 and Q1 2018-19, we'll publish guidance on how the financial statements will change in the context of IFRS 15 and on the changes in our KPIs. We'll, if there's demand, host a meeting to go through these new disclosures in more detail. We've also taken the decision to change the way in which we report Q1 and Q3 results, starting in 2018-19 by moving to shorter trading statements. We'll still produce the key financial metrics, including revenue and EBITDA by unit, and of course, our operational KPIs, to allow the market to model and value the business. Half-year and full-year financial results disclosures will be unchanged, although we do intend to replace a physical meeting at the half year with a conference call and webcast format. Lastly, we intend to introduce a rolling series of business briefings. The sessions will be hosted by the business unit CEOs and their leadership teams, and there'll be an ideal opportunity to understand more about the strategy and the operations of each business unit and to get visibility to our next level of management. We expect the first of these will be in the first quarter 2018-19. Just finally, on slide 23, I'd like to confirm that there has been no change to our outlook for 2017-18. Specifically, we expect revenue to be broadly flat year-on-year, EBITDA of 7.5 billion-7.6 billion pounds, and normalized free cash flow of 2.7 billion-2.9 billion pounds. With that, I'll hand you back to Gavin.
Thank you, Simon. Let me summarize before opening for questions. Today, we've shown that we are delivering against our strategy, and we are responding to market challenges with a robust set of actions. The experience we are offering our customers is improving substantially. We're poised to invest even further in the U.K.'s digital infrastructure with accelerated FTTP and superfast speeds for all subject to regulatory support. TT Consumer and EE are being brought together, and we look forward to continuing to drive convergence in our products and services. We're delivering on our group-wide business improvement plans and tackling challenges in global services. Looking ahead, I'm confident in the steps we are taking to improve the performance of BT for all our stakeholders. Thank you. With that, I'll now take questions. Very good. Okay, we'll use the usual format, right to left. Good to see you all sitting in the same places as normal. If you could wait for the mic to come and introduce yourself so everybody in the audience knows who you are. I will start with Paul up here, please, and then we'll move down here along this row.
Good morning. It's Paul Sidney, Credit Suisse. I was just wondering in terms of the dividend and use of cash, there's clearly a lot of key events coming up. I was just wondering, where does the dividend rank in terms of the use of cash list? Do we start with a progressive dividend and then see what's left for other things, or is it a case that the dividend will be driven by these key events, EPL, pension, et cetera? Thank you.
Well, I think we've been clear in the presentation today that we've reiterated the progressive dividend policy. For us, that means, and I think it's a common held definition, to maintain or grow the dividend, taking into consideration earnings and investment. There's no change in that. We've reiterated our guidance at the same time. These are a solid set of results that I think underpin that. In terms of the uses of cash, it is a balance, ultimately. We need to make sure that we invest in value-creating infrastructure investments in particular, and then ensure that the pension is fully paid and supported, that we're able to pay down our debt over time, and also pay the progressive dividend in line with the policy. When it works, everything is mutually supporting of each other. There isn't, in that respect, a prioritization. Key is ensuring that we get the right investment profile going forward.
The FTTP investment in
Openreach. I'd say more generally around investments. The FTTP consultation that we're undertaking in particular is just one of those, I think. Very good. Just in front of you, yeah. Thank you. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, good morning. It's Jerry Dellis from Jefferies. Just a question on FTTP and then on sports rights, please. On FTTP, if Ofcom were to adhere to the draft WLA proposals, which are obviously quite harsh, would there be scope for Openreach to enter into a negotiation with the regulator next year around a fair bet framework for faster full fiber deployment. And then the question on sports rights, really, within the consumer activities, how important do you believe the Premier League rights that you have are today to the maintaining the loyalty of your customers and your ability to raise prices?
Well, on FTTP, the case for FTTP is a challenging one. I think you all know that. It's the long-term payback, and it needs a number of conditions to be true for it to be a good use of capital, I think. That includes ensuring that there's a regulatory framework that encourages investment. Critical to that is ensuring that the TEA price is not depressed in a way that makes the overall absolute returns that you can get through FTTP unattractive. So it is one of the factors we need to take into account, Jerry. We've been working across the industry. Clive has been building support across all infrastructure investors to make this point very clearly to government, because it doesn't just affect BP, it affects Virgin, it affects City Fibre, affects anybody who is investing in the UK, and we know it is something that's very important to government. So, there was a piece in I think it was the Telegraph that around a letter that Karen Bradley had written to Ofcom, indicating it was important from a government policy perspective to ensure that there was enough in the business case for FTTP. And the connection with FTTC and GEA was made very clearly on that. So it's an ongoing discussion. We feel Ofcom are listening to our, the points we're making, we need to find a way of making sure we make a fair return. It's not just the only issue or the only condition that needs to be true, of course. The one I mentioned in my presentation around switchover from copper to fibre is critical as well, and we need widespread support from CPs to make that switchover. I might actually ask Clive just to give a little bit of colour on the consultation, actually, in terms of support, because I think it would be helpful.
Yeah. Okay. In order to embark on a really large-scale fibre-to-the-premise deployment, we are going to need the support of CPs, but we need them to lean in on the idea of a switchover approach. There will have to be an increment on wholesale pricing. We will need support from Ofcom, and there are a bunch of dimensions to that. So, for example, we're challenging the amount of equipment that needs to be put into the home. Right now we're obliged to put in battery backup. That is not a very useful thing, but it adds to our cost base. So we would, we are right now dialoguing to understand how we can eliminate that cost. And we need assistance from government, so central and local government, for example, to reduce the cost and complexity and the delays associated with street works and traffic management. And the basic physicals of deployment in the streets across the UK. So we need to collaborate with CPs, with government and with Ofcom, because it's clear from the consultation that everybody wants this to go ahead. But we have to do it in a way that makes economic sense. So it's about creating the business case and bringing all of those parties together to create that sensible business case.
Then on sports rights, I'll just maybe say a couple of points, and I know Mark will want to comment on it. BT Sport is performing well. If you look at the audience numbers, up 8% in terms of viewership. The customer numbers are good as well, underpinning that. We are, and I've made this clear on a number of occasions, we don't need to be number one. We need to be a strong number two, and we think we've got a good set of rights to take that position at the moment. The Premier League rights are important. I'm not going to deny that. We will undoubtedly play a role in the auction when we see the ITT, which should be coming out in the next few months. But we will remain very disciplined. Ultimately, we know what it's worth to us, but we're not going to lose our heads on it. We're prepared for a scenario if somebody is prepared to take us or anybody else on in the auction, then we do know what we would do. So I know Mark recently obviously taken on the combined role across B2 Consumer and E, and I don't know if you just mentioned your own perspective on this.
Yeah, I'd echo a lot of everything you say there, Gavin. I mean, there's no doubt in a slowing broadband market, our focus is going to be on increasing RGUs per subscriber. That's going to be a really important strategy for us, working with the customer base we have. And content is a way to differentiate your offering as a network provider. And we can see that our customers are enjoying the product. Our viewing is up pretty significantly year on year because of the English teams in the Champions League. And as the majority of our customers are now paying for sports as well on BT TV, we're still seeing a reasonable level of performance on our TV product. But we are very clear what price we are prepared to pay for these rights, and we will not bid beyond that.
Very good. Simon.
Simon Reading from City. Maybe I can come back to the point on Openreach's consultation. One of your contestants suggested that the summary was a little on the brutal side, and I wondered if you'd give us any more colour around, particularly around the mandatory cutover and what feedback you got.
The summary was on the blueprint stuff.
Yeah, it's short.
Oh.
That's what I mean. Left out a nuance, shall we say. And in particular, I'd be interested in any nuances you've got on the share on mandatory cutover, because that's obviously...
Sure. It might be better. Clive, do you want to just give a bit more colour on it? Given it's your colour.
Well, I apologise if it was straightforward and punchy. That was actually my intent. We're very serious about wanting to build this big fiber platform, and we're going to have to be very straight with all parties, with government, with regulator, and with CPs about what it's going to take to create an environment where that is sensible to build, right? So, you know, in a sense, it's not about being nuanced, it's about being dead straightforward. It is very clear to me that we need a switchover arrangement. So an arrangement where once we've built the infrastructure in an area, then within a certain time frame, the customers on today's Openreach platform move to the new fiber platform. And that way you socialise the cost, as it were, of that very large scale investment over a big base. Everyone gets the benefit because they're now on a platform that is more reliable. Speeds are not only higher, but more consistent, exhibits lower latency. We expect the CPs to benefit because they will have a lower cost of ownership for their customers because of the reliability and consistency of the platform. End customers will benefit because they will be able to move up speed tiers, to very high levels. They will be able to work with their CPs to buy applications, the like of which can now be supported over very high bandwidth services. So we see that everybody can win here. We need them to understand the value of the wins that are within their grasp and to work with us on creating the business case that works for all parties and works for the nation.
The conditions they may put on supporting the mandatory cutover, because the statement yes. says the CP broadly supported it, something.
Yes, so I think...
So what does that mean in terms of
being
able to support it? Is it only costing their fiber, or is it supported if it's, done 3 weeks?
So what we're saying in our summary is that they understand that economically it is clear that this case will work if we switch over all customers. They understand that point. What we're going to do in our next round of consultation is be more specific about how we think switchover will work, what the pricing will look like, and what the footprint would look like, where we would go and in what sequence. Steve.
And I'll address you, Michael, and then Nick.
Steve Martin from Arity. I'll start with a request, please, Simon. No meeting on IFRS 15. Just to the slides. That would be completely fine.
It was going to be a series of these things, actually.
That's a roadshow. Fantastic. We'll get corporate access people to speak to you. A couple of questions, one on consumer and one coming back to Openreach. One on consumer, and one of the many sad tasks I perform on a daily basis as a telco analyst, I was looking at the cheapest way of getting an iPhone in the UK at the moment. And I found if I wanted to get sort of 2 gig version, the cheapest way was to do it through Virgin Media through Carphone Warehouse. So an MVNO through an indirect distributor, which strikes me as sort of borderline insane. You talked about slowing broadband growth generally and the need for more RGUs and, you know, getting more value from your customers. I mean, is it time to just rethink that distribution model, because those offers are being funded by money that you're giving to indirect distributors, obviously, to just keep cycling these customers around the market? So I guess that's question one. And secondly, just coming back to the sort of whole FTTP open reach debate, I mean, do you actually think that the sort of EU-led regulatory toolkit is fit for purpose in trying to get you where you want to get to? And if it's not, does Brexit create an opportunity possibly to rethink that whole construct? Is Ofcom open to that idea? And if that is the case, should we expect any real movement on FTTP this side of Brexit?
Good question. Maybe, do you want to just talk to the first question about distribution and the cost of what is it, an iPhone 8 you're looking for? A 2 gig? You're a generous Dan.
Yeah, I don't do much data, really. I don't.
All right, do you want to talk to that?
Although I know why Virgin's giving away handsets at less than cost.
Our operators offer some distribution strategies. I mean, we're doing a big piece of work now, as you can imagine, as we brought the two units together, looking at our full go-to-market opportunity, distribution, and all other elements of marketing. We'll be able to update you on that in the new year. But we continue to work with a large number of partners across the market, many of whom we have long-term relationships with, long-term contracts. So I'm not expecting any significant change in that in the short term, but we'll update you more in the new year on distribution.
And on FTTP, generally EU framework has been, I think, mildly, positive for infrastructure providers over the last 10 years, and provides, I think, a good oversight. It gets a better balance between investment and competition in many ways. The cycle of market reviews, however, every 3 years is in my view, is crazy. Given that we're talking 15, 20-year paybacks on some of these investments, to have to continue to look at market definitions and have this uncertainty around regulatory pricing on a three-year cycle is not ideal, and it doesn't make it, it's not always conducive to creating the conditions for new investments like FTTP, because the markets are not always formed, and you've got to be able to make the investments up front before you can get to the return. So look, it is, I think, a finely balanced argument that we're better with regulation in or out. As I say, to date, it has, I think, been a net positive. We get access to the 28 markets. Data flows move seamlessly. The standard regulation between all the markets, that's, I think, always been a net positive to us. But if there was a way to moving to a longer time frame for market reviews that gave us some better, some more certainty around pricing, that frankly underpinned the fair bet when we're putting private capital, our shareholders' capital at risk, that we are going to get a return. And maybe we look at different regulatory models going forward. But, I think that's all for, the future. And I don't think, we can wait on FTTP that long. I mean, the challenge with the FTTP debate is it's a 25-year project list, and I think everybody has a common belief that, at some point we're going to need to replace the copper network with fibre, and we're going to need to do some every year. It's more a question of how fast we start and how early we start, and most importantly, how do we make a return on it? And do so in a way that's fair to all stakeholders. I would say I'm hopeful, I think the consultation. I was pleased with the the conclusions out of the consultation from a BT Group perspective, because I think it demonstrated that there's a couple of things. One is there's a belief that across the industry that we need to do this at some point, and it will need there'll need to be trade-offs and sacrifices made by everybody. But once we've been through this transition, we will have the best network, or one of the best networks across the world. They recognise it's going to take a long time. They recognise they're going to have to do switchover. They recognise that prices will have to go up to pay for it, and we can't ultimately keep doing this in an environment where the price of broadband comes down. It doesn't make sense. Now, turning that into this is a proposal, is what we need to do next. And there's a lot of work to do to make that to make that happen. But we're absolutely committed to try and find a way. Do you want to add anything?
No, I think you covered it. I mean, I think the question of 3-year sequential reviews of different products creates issues around predictability. It creates issues of how different costs are allocated. Gavin's addressed that. I think the other issue, if I may, is that, and I think it's perhaps what you're getting to in terms of switchover, it requires a different model, because as Clive described, one formulation for doing this is that everybody connected pays some sort of additional price, and that tests the current form of regulation. We are encouraged that in the consultation today that is recognised. We're engaging with CPs, regulator, all parties, to see if there is a solution to that. Everybody wants to see this investment move forward. We're constructively engaged in finding solutions to it, and I wouldn't preclude a particular timing for arranging that.
Very good. Nick, Wilson, Michael.
Yeah, morning, Gavin. It's Nick at SocGen. Can I ask two, please? Just a very quick one on the dividend first. Was the chairman involved in the discussion on keeping the progressive?
I'll make that very quick. Yes.
And secondly, then on the on fibre and the cutover. Could you give us an idea of the maintenance cost, like for like, between the copper network and the fibre network, please? Because we all get the idea that prices might move up, but surely there's a huge incremental growth margin here for you, as well as your maintenance costs come down if you can cut out copper and the CPs. I agree.
Clive, do you want
The fault rate on fibre is considerably lower than the fault rate on a copper network. So we expect that to benefit the end customer. We expect that to benefit the CP. They'll just have less calls from their customers. And we will roll less trucks because there will be less fixing to do. Now, we've studied around the world and on our current FTTP footprint. What the saving is on truck rolls. So we achieve in the region of half the truck rolls on an FTTP platform, and we're looking at where we need to get that to over time, because we think there's more to be achieved there.
So it's worth saying that that modelling has flowed into our economic evaluation of this. It's flowed into the sorts of cost recovery that's required. And we have looked ahead at that prospective reduction and built that into our economics.
Wilson.
Yeah. Hi there, it's Wilson Price from the World Bank of Canada. Open Interest said it's open to co-investment. Can you tell us how that would work in practice without falling foul of the equivalence of inputs requirements? Is the only way to do that sort of carving out a mini open reach in each individual town you have a co-investor in? And I guess a corollary of that question is, would that cause problems with the pension scheme if they have first claim on any network?
Okay, there's two questions there. Let's start, Clive, on sort of co-investment. And obviously, you've got to respect who you're talking to around that. And then Simon will talk on the pension and they want to add about co-investment.
So it's early days. We are open to discussions with other parties about co-investment. We're exploring different models. We've had some conversations during the consultation period, so ideas from various CPs on different kinds of co-investment model. So this is all for analysis and discussion. What is clear to me, though, is that if somebody co-invests,
They do it for a reason. They do it to have an advantage on that piece of network. And of course, that would need to be discussed in the detail for a specific instance of co-investment with the regulator.
Yeah, and I'd also add to that, Guy, that the word co-investment could also encompass longer-term contractual arrangements, take-or-pay types of arrangements, capacity sharing arrangements as well. Those are in effect co-investment because the long-term contract has to get supported by credit and balance sheet on the counterparty, but it is more straightforward in terms of thinking about the ownership and the account of the asset. In terms of your question on the pension fund, we are, as we've explained, considering various arrangements through which the BT pension scheme may have claim on BT assets as part of the contribution to address the deficit. The foundation of that clearly is existing assets that are measurable and identifiable. There has been a separate debate about if assets are added, do those go into that structure, how could they get treated? So there's quite a lot of options and flexibility around how that could get organised in a world in which there might be some co-investment in certain parts of the network in the future.
Very good. Michael? And then we'll move behind you.
Yeah, just two quick questions. Firstly, moving to global services, I think the new strategy is very clear. So I was just wondering how long you think it will take to feed through to results. And by that, I mean two things. Firstly, how big is the potential runoff of revenues here that you touched on? And secondly, how long does it take to reshift the priority away from the smaller single country customers to the bigger customers? And then just a quick follow-up on the dividend policy wording. I mean, should we read anything into the fact that you effectively said the interim policy for FY19 will be 30% of FY18? And should we think that potentially gives you the flexibility to announce a dividend policy for FY19 in May 2019, as opposed to coming to the market in FY18 and saying this is our forward-looking dividend policy like you've done historically?
I can answer that. No, you
should read anything into that.
The forward-looking dividend policy.
Well, let's be clear. We will, the board will take its decision over the full-year dividend with the full-year results, where we, in the context of the latest business plan, the guidance for the year ahead, and so forth. It will take that decision for the full year, and it will continue to have its progressive dividend policy. But it will be announcing a dividend, as we do today, for the year, and a final dividend. So I don't think you should interpret any change from that approach.
It's not just at the end of this year, it's beyond.
Our dividend policy is a progressive dividend policy, that's right.
Very good. And on global services, it isn't an overnight change. We've got to migrate or transform the business over 2 to 3 years, I would say. And we started on the cost base, and we've updated you on progress today. I think there's more to do there, ultimately. We've talked about introducing the new products and services around dynamic network services, and the announcements we've made this week on Agile Connect and the relationship with AWS, a step in that direction, but it's still relatively early doors. We'll continue to transform the business, focus on multinationals. It means over time, I think some of the local access networks outside of the UK will become less important to us, but we have no news to update you on that at the moment. But I know Bas is relatively new in the job. Do you want to add a little bit of colour from your perspective?
Yeah, sure. Michael, a couple of things. I think on your question on how long will it take, it will depend a little bit clearly on how the market moves in the new areas that we invest in and how well we can utilize the assets where the domestic clients are on at the moment. I think it will take a while for us to see that go through the whole system. I do think as of today, we have already implemented very strong prioritization of our investments into the new areas rather than into the old, whilst we continue to focus on utilization of our domestic assets, you know, until otherwise. We invest most of our money today in dynamic network services as well as in our security portfolio going forward. And those are the two areas that I expect to see traction in the next 2 years.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. It's Usman from Berenberg. I've just got two questions, please. The first question was just on the FTTP consultation. Obviously, you mentioned there's broad service provider support for it. Is that support, you know, conditional on the WLA charge control proposed by Ofcom staying in place, or is it just irrespective of what happens to that? You know, that is you guys interesting enough. The second question was just on global services. This move to software-defined wide area networks, you know, I mean, it's being written upon as kind of deflationary, but from a top-line perspective. But it would be interesting to hear, you know, what kind of return on investment this kind of new business model yields relative to the old one. Thanks.
So five on FTTP, five on FDM.
Yeah. Through the consultation, it was very clear that the CPs acknowledge that they would love their customers over time to move to a more reliable, more consistent platform that can offer higher speeds and support a wider range of applications. That's what they were saying to us. They didn't link in their responses in any tangible way those statements, those points of feedback to what might be happening in the WLA.
Yeah, I think software-defined networks clearly have a different financial profile than our current MPLS offerings, simply because it uses less of our own assets and more of partners' assets. I also think so that will have an impact on the top line. The margin we make is not so much on the resale of the infrastructure itself. The margin we make is on the services on top, clearly. So the one who actually can implement managing end-to-end availability of the software across the networks, that's where the value sits, and that's where the margin sits. And we have models that predict how much margin that will give us. But first, we're very, very much focused on becoming the best at it on a global scale, and then I think that's where we'll find our upside, and not so much in revenue, more in the margin across the management of the service itself.
Thank you, Colin.
Yeah, hi, it's Phil Zhang from UBS. I just have two questions. The first one is on Openreach. When you're thinking about the returns from investing in FTTP, do you think it's possible to get a premium for FTTP versus VDSL? The reason why I'm asking the question is you've got people like CityFibre being very aggressive in terms of wholesale pricing, but also you're talking about migrating subscribers very quickly over to the platform, CPs like Sky and TalkTalk and anything coming. As you would think about wholesale pricing for FTTP. Second question is really about the new chairman, because I think he's highlighted improved customer service as a priority. So does this imply further costs and more investment for this?
Do you want to talk about pricing and the first question, the FTTP question, and I'll tackle the question on customer service.
Yeah, so look, there is something very significant in it, the move from a copper platform to a full fiber platform, an FTTP platform, for the CP. They have the opportunity to compete harder in the marketplace because they will be offering services over, you know, a world-class platform. They will be able to offer higher speeds and associated higher prices. They will be able to sell other applications that use the higher competence of this fiber network, and they will save money in their service to their end customers because there will be fewer faults and a better consistency of service. So there is plenty in it for the CPs, and we're dialoguing with them through that consultancy process to, you know, help them understand all the advantages to them. That being so, that should allow them to recognize that a higher wholesale price is justified in terms of their own economics. And it's that kind of discussion and debate that we had during this phase of the consultation.
We have recognised that, well, they have acknowledged that they are willing to pay a premium in terms of all people.
They understand that we will build this platform if we can create a business case. We have been very clear with them that that business case will stand if we can achieve a wholesale price increase and a switchover mechanism. There are a few other things that we have to do, but those are two core things, and we've been very clear, very open, very transparent about the need for those two things. In the next phase of the consultation pre-Christmas, we will be more specific about what that price premium has to look like and the nature of the switchover that we anticipate. And we'll take their reaction on those more specific points.
Then on service polo and customer experience in general, the chairman is a strong supporter of our strategy. He's been on the board since June. He's seen the progress we've been making, and you could see it from the slides we were showing earlier, over the last 18 months. And we see, you know, we've got good visibility of that going forward. And we're having an impact on both the operating metrics, the RFT metric that we've been using for several years, but also on Net Promoter Score, using techniques such as Medallia, which is a system of getting closed-loop feedback into the business direct from customers. So we're seeing the dial move on all aspects of this moving at the moment. The investments we've been making in service are bearing fruit. You can see that in the fault rate in the Openreach network. So in spite of usage of that network going up probably 50% year on year behind broadband, the underlying fault rate is coming down. And this has been, you know, that is reversing a trend that has been going the opposite direction for several years. You can see the investments we're making in UK contact centres because we know customers prefer to speak to somebody from the UK. That costs more. We've been trailing that through the numbers to you for a number of quarters now, but we're seeing that coming through in customer satisfaction. You're seeing the investments in digital coming through as people want to serve themselves. And we're also investing more generally in PTC, prevention to call type propensity to call type investment, so that people don't have to contact you in the first place. And then finally, we're also investing a lot more in bandwidth. So we want to make sure the products themselves, you know, are the best available. That can be in the form of, you know, fixed bandwidth in the fibre market, but it's also 4G coverage and 4G speeds through the EE network. So there's a lot of investment. The chairman is 100% behind it. He understands that the future of the business really, amongst other things, depends on having fantastic customer service and a great customer experience, and he's strongly endorsed that.
The other thing I'd say, Gavin, is this is not a quarter by quarter.
No.
This is a long-term strategy we have, because we know that by improving the experience our customers get, that's going to drive a more sustainable, more valuable revenue stream in the long term. It will also actually drive better productivity as well. If you look at what's happened to Right First Time growing up, that means there are fewer things to fix. And that ultimately will also drive efficiency through the business. So we set out on this knowing it's a long-term journey to get ahead and stay ahead of competitors and bring better value to customers.
Got it. Sunil's behind you, looking for a question.
Thank you. Yes, it's Sunil from Bank of America. Question actually more for Mark Allaire now. I think, Mark, you've been in the role as head of the combined continuing for 3 months. What are your impressions of what you can sort of do to drive growth in this business going forward, clearly in a more challenging consumer environment? I'm interested, especially as you've come from the EE side, of how you can bring that closer to the BT broadband business, and should we see new products, bundles, even possibly discounts over the next 6 to 12 months. Thank you.
Mark.
Hi there. It's actually only 2 months rather than three, so still early days. But what's clear is the opportunity ahead of us is significant. We've got three great brands. We've got a very large customer base. We've got fantastic people. We've got fantastic distribution. And with a fixed and mobile network, the opportunity to bring converged products and services to customers along with our content is also significant. And there are many households where we only have one relationship with the customer, either on the BT brand or the EE brand. And there are millions of households where we have no relationship at all. So what my team and I are working on at the moment, and as I said before, we'll be able to come out and explain our plans in the new year to all of you. We're working on our plan to make the most of the brands and the market opportunity we have, which is significant. And part of that will be converged bundles and offers, as you say, brought together for customers. I'm less excited about discounts. I'm more excited about more for more, bringing customers more value, better experiences, a better, more joined up network experience, which we can provide along with content to differentiate as well.
Very good. I think Sam and then Sue.
Morning, guys. Sam from Exam here. Two questions. First on content. I think I've heard a couple of times you say you know what the content is worth to you guys. I think you're spending $700 to $800 million a year at the moment. Now, if you look at the direct revenue earned, it kind of pretty much matches one for one. How, when your shareholders ask you, how are you making money on sport, what do you tell them? What is the math that you run through to kind of explain how much money? And obviously, you don't want to give anything away in terms of auction bidding, so as much as you can give us. And then on the pension, the kind of the Section C members and the CPI switch, I guess in 2011 when you did this in Section A and B, you must have investigated it for Section C. Why now? What's changed? And there are a few companies who have made this move, and specifically they've not mentioned RPI in their trust deed and rules. What does your trust deed and rules say for Section C members? Thank you.
Do you want to talk about the Section C versus Section A and B?
Yes. I mean, obviously this is a subject to a court hearing, and therefore I don't think it's appropriate to say much more than we have looked at the scheme. We don't believe that RPI is a relevant measure. We believe that CPI is more so, and that will be something that will be examined and ruled upon in early December. Really not appropriate to say more at this stage. Sorry, what? The scheme has historically used RPI. That's right. Yeah. Content?
On content. Look, the strategy on BT Sport has always been to look at the impact it has across the business as a whole. And if you recall, when we launched, initially it was free, and that was key to drive scale and get critical mass. But over time, we've moved it to a paid-for proposition, which is why the direct revenues have increased a lot more. But ultimately, we see it as the opportunity to grow it from here is reasonable. So one of the things I know Mark is particularly interested in is not just looking at the fixed base, but how can we get more out of the mobile base across all our brands. And that's one of the areas you're looking at going forward. So it will evolve over time. It's paying for more of its own content as a direct revenue stream now, but ultimately we see it as a way of differentiating ourselves across all of our three brands. Okay, Stephen. Sorry, James.
I might look apologies. Like Stephen Howard some days.
My apologies.
Yeah, so two questions, please. First one was on the FTTP consultation, second one on BT. So kind of engaging with your stakeholders, interesting discussions you're having with government, because kind of rising utility bills in general has been something that's been in the UK. I mean, obviously what you're proposing here effectively is a pricing so with the proposed model. Just interested in the kind of government reaction you're getting to that. Are they willing to back that? And in the consultation in July, I think you talked about a £7 in value per line that you were looking for. I mean, now you're talking maybe the cost bills could be coming down, there could be some OPEX saving. I mean, can you help quantify what kind of price increase we might. And then the second question is on BT Consumer. I mean, revenue growth there seems to slow quite sharply this quarter from about 7 to 1%. Could you help us kind of dig into the underlying trends there? Is there anything specific to call out this quarter? Is that something we can expect to recover in the coming quarters?
Okay. On FTTP, maybe I'll just say a few words and then I'll pass to Clive, and then I'll pick up the revenue streams in consumer. In terms of the discussions with government, you know, there is strong there's a strong desire to go to what they call full fibre networks, what we call FTTP, going forwards, to ensure that the UK stays right at the front of the pack in terms of digital infrastructure and in terms of the digital economy in general. And particularly as we navigate our way through Brexit, they see the digital economy is one of the key drivers of economic growth over the medium term. So they understand that ultimately if you want to build a network like that and you want to build it across the whole of the UK and you want to make it available at a wholesale level, that the economics have to support that. You can't put that capital at risk if there is long-term decline in wholesale prices. It just doesn't work. I mean, and in terms of comparing us with the utilities, I don't know whether you've ever seen a chart that looks at our pricing in our market versus electricity, water, or gas since 1990, and it demonstrates, I think, what a great job the UK infrastructure providers have done at driving down costs over the long term within network and continuing to invest over that time period. I think it supports the model that has worked, I think, significantly, because costs have come down. I forget the number, but it's sort of 30 to 40% over that period, whereas there's been inflation and everything else. So, you know, in the telecoms market, you've got better products at lower unit prices. You know, it's fueled, it's funded innovation and investment. You know, inflation in other utilities where perhaps they haven't had the same sort of innovation. So I feel very, confident that there is a strong case to make this investment. People understand that we have to get a return, and they will be supportive of it. But if we don't have that, we can't make the case. I mean, it is pretty straightforward like that. Do you want to just add any colour in terms of the sort of dynamics around the £7?
Conversation with government isn't just about pricing, it's about how they can help us in other ways. So, for example, they could help us reduce our cost to build by giving us improved arrangements for Wayleys, for street works, for traffic management, etc. That's very significant. DCMS now have set up a barrier-busting team, actually, which is helping us with those issues and helping to reduce our cost base. So it's not just about their appetite for price rises, it's about how can they materially help us get our cost points down. And they, DCMS have been very helpful in that regard.
In terms of the ARPU movement in consumer, it does move around depending on the timing and the sequencing of pricing changes year on year. So, now, we're very confident that the strategy of more for more, driving RGUs per customer, driving dual play, triple play, quad play is the right one for us. So that's really what explains the sort of quarter-on-quarter change. If anything, you know, very good. Okay, John.
Thank you. It's John Currius from Numis. So two questions, please. So how soon will significantly more EE shops start to retail BT and Plusnet fixed line services? And then secondly, I've got a question about on business and public sector. You don't guide for line of business EBITDA. I'm just trying to consider whether over the next few years the trend in that will be up, down, or sideways. So how should I think about issues like volume, pricing, and OPEX, please?
Very good. Mark on shops, and then Graham, do you want to comment on the dynamics you're seeing?
Yeah, we already have a number of stores selling BT alongside E at the moment. They're in trial. Those trials are going very well. And as part of our review, as we bring the BT consumer and the divisions together, distribution, as I said before, is going to be a major part of that. There's no doubt the stores are a big asset. They're nationwide. We're growing that store base. And we'll be able to update you on our plans in the new year. I mean at the
full year
results, right. End of the financial year. Yeah.
Okay. Well, on business and public sector, you know, I think we've been clear and transparent, you know, that it would take 2 years for the public sector contract that we'd lost in 2014, 2015, and early 2016 to wash through our business. You can see the improving trend on our major and public sector division in terms of revenue. You know, during that period, we've also been working very hard on our sales capability distribution to really strengthen the organization, working very hard on customer experience in line with a lot of the comments you've heard to drive down our cost base. And, you know, where we are in terms of the contracts that we've lost, we're 18 months into that two-year period now from what we've disclosed in previous quarterly results around those revenues. They're, you know, largely 50% down, you know, after that 18-month period. Our expectation now is that we will retain half of what still remains on those contracts. And probably around the end of the fiscal year, we will be in a steady state contract position in relation to that. So my expectation is you will see, because of that and because of all the other activity that we put in place, a strengthening performance relative to what you see today. Now, obviously, we're not going to disclose what that will be, but certainly, you know, our confidence around, you know, our sales order position, our cost base, etc., has improved, you know, the underlying performance of the business is strong. You can see it from what we disclose in mobile today, you know, with 9% revenue growth year-on-year in Q2, which is a significant improvement, you know, on the integration of the businesses with the business as it's come in. So, you know, the underlying strength of the business is improving and increasing our confidence in the future.
Thanks, John.
Robert.
Thank you. Robert from Deutsche Bank. I have to speak very clearly because I was misquoted in the last transcript, and it's important to put the public record straight. I was gutted, G-U-T-T-E-D, that you lost your beard.
what was it translated?
It was good that you lost your
beard. Oh, right. Obviously, my wife had intervened.
You are my role model.
It shows in your recommendation.
I'm still my own man. Thank you. So a couple of quick questions. Going back to pensions, I'm afraid. Simon, would it be able to give us a bit of order of magnitude impact of the change to the deficit should the scheme go from RPI to CPI for those class of pensioners or participants? Secondly, if you close the scheme again, what would be the impact, roughly? I know you can't be specific. I suppose there would be... you'd have to pay something else to those employees to compensate them for losing their rights, the rough impact on what that might be on EBITDA. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's impossible, but the asset transfers, it sounds like you're thinking much more than property transfers. Is there an order of magnitude to put on that possibility?
Mm-hmm. So starting with your final question, no, I'm not going to put an order of magnitude. We're talking across a sort of wide range of potential solutions for addressing the deficit. To your second question, closing the scheme doesn't impact deficit, which is obviously a reflection of liabilities accrued to date. What it impacts is the cost of providing pensions moving forward, and you take a consideration of that between... In the hypothetical scenario described for closing a scheme, you're obviously going to provide a DC alternative, and then there are discussions around the structure of that DC versus a DB scheme. Of course, there are other alternatives. You don't close the scheme, but you modify the DB accrual. And all of that is something that we need to consider with our employees and with the unions. And your first question, I have seen external estimates of the impact of the RPI to CPI switch that put it in the sort of 1 to 2 billion sort of range, and that's probably not a bad estimate for the sort of impact.
So what's the one for Devon, actually? Quick one for Devon. Rural broadband. You made a voluntary approach. It all looks good. Why is that? Quickly, why is that getting bogged down?
You're right. On UBC, Universal Broadband Commitment, I think we made a good offer to the government, and they're considering it at the moment. There has been a wee bit of noise in the press, as you know. I don't know whether that will ultimately have an impact on whether they want to move forward with it. But if the government want to deliver against their manifesto commitment, frankly, this is the only way really to do it. And the manifesto commitment is 10 megs available for everybody, at least 10 megs, by 2020. And frankly, we're running out of time. So, we think this is a good offer. It's the right thing to do for everybody across the country. It's very cost effective, and hopefully we'll get a decision soon. Thank you.
I quite like 10 megabits in rural SW13.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Nick.
Thanks, Nick Gaffers from Redburn. So the really hugely bright spot of the results was EE, and I just wanted to ask you, what was the EBITDA growth if you were to adjust for the roaming impact? And secondly, on the same subject, I think it's EE anyway, you've got the ESN contract, which we read is delayed. Could you talk a little bit about, I mean, obviously you don't want to talk too much about the contract, I guess, but when do you expect to see material profit from that contract hitting your account?
Do you want to take this?
I'm not going to do the rapid-fire mental arithmetic on the roaming, but clearly it was one headwind on the performance, and I dimensioned that in my remarks. In terms of low tens for the quarter, and we'd indicated high tens for the full year. In terms of the ESN contract, the contract, as you know, is running behind, although we've hit our deadline for the recent milestone in Q2, and we continue to fulfill our part of the contract and continue to make progress on that. The revenue will build over time as the wider contract is completed. I don't know if Mark has anything further you want to say to that.
No, I wouldn't have into that.
Yeah, we've hit our milestones, continue to do that, working very closely with the Home Office, and nothing more to add.
I mean, the one thing I would say is that it's in building the network. The network is also available for consumers and businesses, and they're benefiting from the extra coverage as of today. Mm-hmm. So I think the coverage is now 86%, isn't it?
86.
Geographic coverage has improved over 20 basis points in the last 18 months.
So if I were to do the number, the EBITDA effectively grew more than 20% if you strip out the roaming costs, and you've got the investment already made for ESN, which is yet to come in, and that will be put in the... Is that correct?
Yes, you're correct on the roaming, and yes, you're correct that over time, there is a directional benefit to come from the extended 4G coverage that ESN provides and some revenue associated specifically with the contract, and that is ahead of us in the plan. But it's also fair to say that we are still in the process of building ESN, and there will be more assets built into our balance sheet as that project continues.
Yeah.
And the CapEx is shown in the ESN, that's right. In the EE, I beg your pardon, that's right.
Yeah, do you want to just mention Apple?
Well, I was going to say, the only thing I'd also add on the EBITDA, I think we talked about it in the results as well, this has been quite an exceptional period for handset launches. You know, we normally have one Apple launch, we've actually had three, but we've had the 10 that's obviously staggered and is now in this quarter. So, you know, I think we need to certainly, at the very least, get to the end of next quarter and probably into the final quarter of the year to see the full impact of these new handset launches in the portfolio. You know, the early signs on the 10 are very strong. I do think there'll be some supply constraints there, so you know it's going to be relatively volatile on the EBITDA side. So you need to take a couple of quarters to smooth it out and get a really clear view of where we're going to be.
I won't put 30% in every quarter.
I think that the other important point to be made, Nick, is that this is a long-term build-out. Be really clear. This takes time for the ESN to build up. We're doing our part. We then have to have the rest of the contract assembled. You've then got to test whether or not and bring all of the sites live. So this is a dynamic that will play out over years, not quarters.
Matthew.
Matthew Blocks from Bloomberg Intelligence. Question on consumer.
I mean, the ARPU growth was still quite respectable, but the revenues slowed down quite markedly, which would imply volumes decelerated quite a bit. But then when you look at the aggregate EE and consumer net losses together, they didn't look especially different to recent quarters. In fact, slightly better. So does that mean that you're essentially getting better traction with EE's fixed offer into the market? And if that's the case, then what does that say about where the BT brand is positioned? Are customers more price sensitive and looking for the kind of slightly kind of cheaper end of the market at the moment?
Now, what we've, I think, said on a couple of quarters now is, you know, we've got three brands, BT, EE, and Plusnet. Each brand has multiple products, and certainly all of them carry fixed and mobile as part of their proposition. And we will use them to target different parts of the market so that we can optimize the value we offer customers and ensure that we don't have to chase price on the BT brand, which is, you know, we want it to be premium price. You know, it's not sensible, I don't think, it's not smart to take the front book down on BT when we've got a really strong brand in Plusnet, which has, you know, just to remind you, it has, you know, easily the highest NPS in the market. So you'll see us using the brands on a category-wide basis to optimize going forward. Mm. Very good. And I always like to finish with Guy.
Thank you. It's Guy Petty from Macquarie. Two quick questions. It might be coincidence, but the decline in EBITDA in global services and the decline in CapEx were very similar. So is that coincidence, or is it a sign that there's been more variability in that CapEx number within global services to allow you to protect cash flow depending on revenues and in particular EBITDA? Mm.
So I think that these are, well, firstly, as we indicated, a meaningful component of the trend in EBITDA was associated with the year-on effects of Italy. As we also described, there was some additional lever and pension costs. There was, however, a trading-related decline in EBITDA. We also explained that's a function of customers coming to the market with smaller contracts, typically with a component of SDN within it, and they tend to be less capital intensive. So it's correlated to the trading, you know, the wider trading environment, less capital intensive. Don't you add to that, Baz?
Yeah, you know, we're focused primarily on cash. So that was a good cash. It's a coincidence that it happens to be the same number, but. Definitely, we're more focused on cash than on top line.
Going back to a question from a colleague from the past, you know, over time, this is a less capital-intensive business model, and over the time, that will play out.
Just one quick follow-up on another issue. With the relationship you now have with Three UK, which is obviously starting to get a little bit fractious, bear in mind your polar arguments in this court case, and given your historic network arrangements, that's the fact that your network is getting so much stronger. Are we gradually seeing the unwind of your previous network sharing agreements with Three as you sort of go it alone a little bit more going forward?
No. The relationship is good. And indeed, Mark and I have spent a lot of time with Hutch and Three management over the last few months as we think about how we move forward on 5G. So look, the nature of this industry is, you know, you can't fall out forever with anybody. You are, you know, your competitors, your suppliers to each other. Sometimes you're in court next to each other. Sometimes you're in court on opposite sides of the table. Sometimes on the same day. It's just the nature of how it is. You compartmentalize issues. You try and respect each other's position, but recognize that sometimes you have to go to court to settle these things. On spectrum, you know, I think we've mentioned this before, but for clarity, you know, we thought the idea of caps was wrong, but we were prepared to go with it because of the number. I think we were being capped at 37%. We felt, you know, we could deliver our business plan at that level. But as a principle, we thought it was wrong. You know, we've managed our spectrum holding well. and we've optimized it and created the right value out of it, and we shouldn't be, I think, punished for that. When Hutch came in and said, actually, we think that is too high and they should be capped at 30, that forced us to come in and protect our position, and that's why we felt obliged to come in and put the counter argument. Very good. Thank you. Have a good day.